All right. So, yeah, what I'll talk about today is turbulence and scattering and how they relate to problems concerning cosmic rays, both the acceleration and the propagation of cosmic rays. Galactic cosmic rays will be what I'll focus on. Really, I'll talk about some of the implications of fairly recent work on anisotropic MHD turbulence and what that implies for our understanding of cosmic ray scattering by turbulence. And it turns out that there's some interesting consequences of anisotropy and turbulence for both how cosmic rays are accelerated and confined to the galaxy. It's a very striking feature of galactic cosmic rays. This here is a plot of the cosmic ray energy spectrum of the galaxy. I measured at the Earth, and you see a power law in the energy spectrum over many decades in energy. It's a very smooth power law from about 1 GeV to about 10 to the 6 GeV, and then the power law steepens somewhat. That steepening feature is called the knee of the spectrum, and then it continues all the way to the very end, and there seems to be a slight flattening at very high energies. This uniformity of the power spectrum over so many decades of energy is a real challenge to explain. It results, like the energy spectrum that is observed results from two things, the acceleration mechanism of cosmic rays and also how they propagate through the galaxy, and both combine somehow to give this remarkably uniform power law. Explaining how propagation and acceleration work to do this is a big challenge. Currently, the leading theory for the origin of cosmic rays is shock acceleration, supernova shock. The idea being that a cosmic ray can diffuse back and forth across the shock, gaining a small amount of energy upon each shock crossing. Scattering plays an important role here in that scattering of a cosmic ray by small-scale magnetic fluctuations on either side of the shock can cause the cosmic ray to go back and forth. The cosmic ray has to go back and forth across the shock many times to be accelerated. There are two mechanisms for giving the cosmic ray energy in this picture. One is the classic Fermi mechanism, where you take converging scattering centers, and the cosmic ray bouncing back and forth between converging scattering centers is like a ping pong ball bouncing back and forth between converging ping pong paddles, gaining energy upon each scattering. There's another mechanism, which is the cosmic ray can diffuse along the face of the shock. There's an electric field along the face of the shock, and the cosmic ray sees a different magnetic field on either side of the shock, and it can diffuse in the direction of the electric field, gaining energy that way as well. Even in that second mechanism, the cosmic ray must bounce back and forth, however. So scattering plays a critical role in shock acceleration. Scattering of cosmic rays by small-scale turbulence is also important for confining cosmic rays to the galaxy. When you look at the cosmic rays that arrive at the Earth, there are a comparatively large fraction in elements such as beryllium and boron, which are very rare in interstellar gas. And the idea is that these nuclei, called secondary nuclei, result from spallation, from when a cosmic ray and an interstellar atom collide. You can fragment a large nucleus into a smaller one, and that's the presumption of how you get these secondary nuclei. The number of secondary nuclei compared to primary nuclei that you see at the Earth, where primary nuclei are taken to be typical of interstellar gas in their composition, the number, sort of the fractional abundance of secondary nuclei tells you how long the cosmic ray has been traveling through interstellar gas. The longer cosmic rays are confined to the galaxy, the more of these secondary nuclei you get. And this gives you an estimate of cosmic ray ages of roughly 10 million years or thereabouts. It depends somewhat on cosmic ray energy. You can also get another estimate of cosmic ray ages by looking at the abundance of radioactive isotopes and their decay products. To explain such large confinement times, you have to appeal to some kind of confinement mechanism, perhaps scattering. The time for a cosmic ray to stream out of the galaxy, the galactic disk, at the speed of light is tiny compared to 10 million years. You can explain the 10 million year figure if the cosmic ray is undergoing a random walk with a step length of about one parsec. So So the classic explanation for cosmic ray confinement is turbulence in the disk gives you scattering of cosmic rays, which gives you a scattering mean free path of this order. It can depend, again, on energy somehow. And that could explain the confinement time of cosmic rays to the galaxy. Now, the scattering that you appeal to, both in shock acceleration and in cosmic ray confinement, can come from turbulence that can arise from two different sources. One of those is that the cosmic rays themselves can generate turbulence, and the other is that the turbulence could result from, say, large-scale stirring of the ISM. And these two different types of sources of turbulence create turbulence with different properties that have different efficiencies of scattering cosmic rays. I'm going to focus on this second mechanism of generating turbulence, but let me say a few words first about this first mechanism, cosmic ray-generated turbulence. It turns out that cosmic ray-generated turbulence is mostly important for relatively low-energy cosmic rays. Cosmic rays, when they stream along the magnetic field faster than the local Alfvén speed, can generate resonant MHD waves. Those can scatter the cosmic rays. But the waves that are generated by cosmic rays, say at the peak of the spectrum, at 1 GeV, are not so efficient at scattering much higher energy cosmic rays. And I could probably say more about this later on, but the basic reason for that is that the modes that the cosmic rays excite have wave numbers that are of order the inverse cosmic ray gyro radius. But the gyro radius of, well, that's true of the modes that the cosmic rays excite, but also the modes that are most effective at scattering cosmic rays satisfy the same criterion. Right, particularly K-parallel. The cosmic rays excited here, the waves excited here, therefore have, you know, wave vectors that are pretty much too large to be effective at scattering much higher energy cosmic rays. Another key point here is that the growth rate of the waves is proportional to the energy density of the cosmic rays. And so the growth rate of waves with k of order rho to the minus 1 of these cosmic rays here, the growth rate is much slower, much less. And in fact, for the resonant waves that would scatter high-energy cosmic rays, the growth rates can fall below damping rates of those same modes, damping associated with thermal plasma. And that means in the case of propagation of cosmic rays in the galactic disk, that above energies of about 100 GeV...
Yeah. Since the waves go nonlinear, you get higher harmonics. Does that help you at all?
You actually would need sort of lower K to scatter these. It goes the other way. For propagation of basically above energies of 100 to 1,000 GeV, the self-excited waves, the waves excited by cosmic rays, can't confine the cosmic rays because the growth rates are too low. They're below the damping rates. And actually,
if the field is curved, does the drift resonance help you at all?
Let's see. If the field is curved, I don't think that will be too big of an issue because the gyro radii that you're talking about are typically much less than curvature lengths of the field line. So that for a microgauss field, the gyro radius of a cosmic ray basically scales like this. It's about 10 to the 12 centimeters times the energy in GeV. Yeah. This times the energy of the cosmic ray in GeV. This point about the self-excited waves is also true for shock acceleration. Above energies about 100 to 1,000 GeV, the growth rates for modes that could scatter those cosmic rays at energies above 100 to 1,000 GeV become so small that you can't excite the waves during the lifetime of a supernova remnant. So to get shock acceleration up to the higher energies that you want, remember in this plot of the power spectrum, really you want to explain cosmic ray acceleration up to at least the knee in the spectrum at a million GeV, possibly higher. to explain.
You're saying the shock acceleration cannot explain the higher the cosmic rays you observe that are isotropic and therefore have a galactic source.
Those probably cannot be explained by parallel shock acceleration. Perpendicular shock acceleration can probably explain it.
Is there any evidence in supernova remnants themselves of evidence of the cosmic rays interacting with the remnants, so you maybe have an idea of what their energies are directly or more directly?
I think you can measure energies and remnants of the electrons, but not the protons, as far as I know. This because of the synchrotron emission that you can see is from the relativistic electrons.
Is there any sort of characteristic temperatures in the background around the supernova remnant that could possibly
help you? You do kind of know the temperatures nearby. In front of the remnant, it would be typical interstellar temperatures depending upon the phase.
Right.
That wouldn't be so critical for this point, however, because the characteristics of this turbulence here won't be too sensitive to that temperature.
At what energy does possible energy loss from the shock to the particles become relevant?
I was treating
the acceleration in a sense self-consistently instead of kinematically.
I think that would become pretty important. Like the idea is that that needs to become pretty important right away, because if you're going to get a significant fraction of your energy into these high-energy cosmic rays, you have to give it to only a very tiny fraction of the particles, and you sort of therefore want to spread out the shock through the kind of effect you're talking about.
But simulations show that.
Yeah.
But half the energy goes in.
Is it half the energy goes in cosmic rays?
You just mentioned cosmic ray generated turbulence.
Right.
Well, it sounds that, are you going back to that?
No, actually, that's what I'm going to go and talk about. Turbulence that is not generated by cosmic rays, that's generated by large-scale stirring, actually. That basically the point I was going to make about the. I'm sorry. What?
This idea is basically out. What's just an idea?
Well, no, it's not necessarily out. This plays a very important role in certain situations. Self-generated turbulence, at least at low energies, below say 100 to 1,000 GeV, the self-excited waves are believed to be very important. At higher energies, the growth rates of those waves are too low, and so you probably need to appeal to the second class of sources of turbulence.
But at low energies, which part of the turbulence do you think you might generate low energy cosmic waves?
Which part of the turbulence spectrum? Well, if you thought about the galactic turbulence spectrum, only a small part of it. So say you think of the power spectrum of galactic turbulence as a function of K, and say it extends from 100 parsecs to the -1 power down to some small dissipation scale, most of this stuff here will be independent of the cosmic rays. Cosmic rays would potentially excite a lot of small-scale turbulence in the vicinities of shocks that could be important for low-energy cosmic rays. To explain scattering of higher-energy cosmic rays, you would want to appeal to this turbulence somehow, which is what I'm going to now go on to talk about.
On the other hand, the turbulence itself causes accelerated cosmic rays, right?
Very weakly, and that's another thing I'll mention. You mean the turbulence here that's generated by stirring, say. It can excite cosmic rays, but if it's anisotropic, that acceleration of cosmic rays is very weak. Very, very slow. Okay, so here's the view graph I'm looking for. Okay, how about this other part of turbulence that's generated by stirring? It turns out that this, if you model this turbulence here as, say, being isotropic in wave number space, in a theory like Kraepelin's theory of MHD turbulence, this can give you quite effective cosmic ray scattering of by the turbulence, effective enough scattering to explain cosmic ray confinement and also even to some extent acceleration by parallel shocks. But if the turbulence generated by large-scale stirring is anisotropic, then the scattering is much weaker. And that's the thing I'm going to go on to talk about here. There's a large body of work investigating the nature of interstellar turbulence, and what I'll do here is take one model, the model of Goldreich and Sridhar, which we will probably be hearing more about, I suspect, for the power spectrum. And the idea here is if you input energy at some large scale L, stirring the interstellar medium through supernova, energy spreads out in the K-perp, K-parallel plane in an anisotropic way, so that you end up exciting regions where K-perp is much larger than K-parallel. So outside of this crosshatched region, the assumption in this model is you would have very little power. The envelope of this region scales like K-parallel, going like K-perp to the two-thirds power times L to the minus one-third power, L being the stirring scale. And the properties of this turbulence or scattering cosmic rays are very different from those of isotropic turbulence. There's one more thing I need to say, though, sort of at the outset about the model I'm going to discuss here. There are two polarizations of incompressible turbulence. Incompressible turbulence is all that I'll consider. If you take B naught to be in the Z direction and K to be in the YZ plane, one of the polarizations of the incompressible modes is the Schierhalfein mode, which has the fluctuating V and B along X, perpendicular to K and B. The other is what is sometimes called the pseudo-Alphain polarization, with the fluctuating fields in the plane of K and B naught. An important difference between these two modes is that the field strength modulation associated with the Schierhalfein mode is very weak, because the perturbation to B is perpendicular to B naught. And so if you take a tiny vector and add it to a that's perpendicular to a large vector, and you add the two vectors just by Pythagorean's theorem, the resulting length, the length of the sum of those vectors is only slightly changed relative to the length of the large vector. For the pseudo-Alphain polarization, that's not the case. You can actually get stronger fluctuations in the field strength, first order in the quantity B1, where B1 is the fluctuating field. It's not exactly clear what the spectra of the pseudo-Alphain modes is compared to the Schierhalfein modes. I'll assume that the two spectra are the same and that the power in both is comparable. The one difference I'll take is the dissipation scale for the Schierhalfein modes I'll assume to be the thermal ion gyro radius, whereas for the pseudo-Alphain modes it probably is something like the collisional mean free path. It turns out that small scale cutoff isn't so important for the scattering of these cosmic rays that we're most interested in.
Collisional mean free path is probably, before that.
For the slow waves? Why would it be before that? Okay, right. It would be, right. Yeah. Like a Reynolds number to the 3/4 times. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it turns out that small scale is not very important for the scattering rates that you get. One more thing, I guess a technical point. One has to assume something about the time correlation of this turbulence. And I take an exponential form for the time correlation function. This turbulence, even though the small scale fluctuations have small amplitude relative to the background field, They're really strong turbulence fluctuations as opposed to linear waves. Most of the work on cosmic ray scattering has worked in the approximation that you can treat the fluctuations as coherent monochromatic waves. And that's not really appropriate for strong turbulence. More appropriate is taking the waves to have a correlation, time correlation function that has a typical width of order the sort of turnover time or energy transfer time of that turbulence. So, for a given turbulence model, how do you calculate scattering rates? The standard method is to use the quasi-linear approximation. And here the approximation is that the fluctuating field is small compared to the background field. That approximation lets you take the particle's orbit to be essentially the same kind of helical orbit you'd get if there were no field fluctuation. At least over lengths comparable to the correlation length of the fluctuation in the magnetic field. That approximation is very useful because if you know where the particle is, it's easier to integrate its equation of motion to find out how it responds to the small-scale fluctuations. in this approximation, what you get is if you have turbulent small-scale fields, as the particle moves along the field, it sees a series of uncorrelated fluctuations. Each of those give it some random kick in velocity space through the Lorentz force. If you get a random series of fluctuations or a random series of kicks in velocity space, that gives you diffusion in velocity space or momentum space. And so through quasi-linear theory, you would calculate diffusion coefficients for these particles in momentum space. How do you justify applying quasi-linear theory to strong turbulence? The presumption here about the spectrum is that where it's stirred, at least at the stirring scale L, the fluctuations in the magnetic field are at least as strong as any background field in the galaxy. Well, what you can do is basically treat the very large scale field, which has most of the energy, as a background field, as a uniform field. It turns out the very largest scale fluctuations don't really affect the cosmic rays' orbits very much. The cosmic rays just move along the large scale field lines. Most of the scattering is, again, dominated by regions where the wave vector k is of order the inverse cosmic ray gyro radius. And for the cosmic ray energies that I'll be focusing on, those k's are pretty large compared to the energy range k's of the interstellar turbulence.
By the way, is that the time correlation with the area or local?
It's not clear what you would really want to use in quasi-linear theory. I've taken it to be what you think of as a Lagrangian correlation time. That probably is appropriate because if you think about, say, the difference in hydro between the two, you get the random sweeping from the large-scale fields. But that shouldn't make too much difference in scattering cosmic rays because the cosmic rays would be moving along with the same E cross B drift as the background plasma. So it's not exactly clear what to use. I take it to be a Lagrangian correlation time. What you take it to be, it's actually not going to be critical for the results. The critical element of the turbulence model is the anisotropy. So given the quasi-linear theory, what do you get for cosmic ray scattering rates? The two types of scattering, one is called gyroresonance scattering. The idea here is probably simplest to understand if you think of monochromatic waves. So I'll talk about that for a minute, then talk about strong turbulence after. If the magnetic field is a background field plus a monochromatic wave, you can get a resonant interaction if you satisfy this condition. Omega minus k parallel v parallel is some integer multiple of the cosmic ray's gyro radius capital omega. V parallel, let me just explain these terms. V parallel is a component of the cosmic ray velocity along the background field, the component perpendicular to the background field. This condition here is basically saying that the frequency of the mode is seen by the cosmic ray is, this omega minus k parallel v parallel is the Doppler shifted frequency in the frame moving with the cosmic ray along the background field. If that Doppler shifted frequency is a multiple of the gyro frequency, you get a resonance. For interstellar turbulence, the typical frequencies of modes are of order k parallel times the Alfvén speed, which for relativistic cosmic rays is much less than this Doppler shift, k parallel times the parallel speed of the cosmic ray, since the cosmic rays are relativistic. So you can typically ignore the time evolution intrinsic to the mode and treat the field as static. And that's basically saying that a cosmic ray zips through a fluctuation before the fluctuation can change. In that case, you get the resonance condition written here. K parallel is of order, or is equal to some multiple of omega times omega over V parallel. If you think about the helix that the cosmic ray is moving along, the distance between successive peaks in that helix is V parallel over omega. So this resonance condition is that the parallel wavelength of the fluctuation is equal to the distance between successive crests. That gives you a resonance if the fluctuation is static. For typical cosmic ray pitch angles, theta, this distance between crests is the same as the cosmic ray gyro radius. And so you recover this condition I was alluding to earlier, that the wavelength of a fluctuation is comparable to the inverse gyro radius of a cosmic ray. That's for this gyro-resonant type interaction.
Ben, how do you pitch angles scatter through V parallel equals zero?
Through V parallel equals zero.
You run into a
hole if you look at just the shear Alfvén waves. If you include pseudo-Alfvén waves, you get actually a huge peak near those values of V parallel. What happens if you talk about strong turbulence instead of these monochromatic waves? Strong turbulence would have frequency spreads of order the linear frequency in the mode. But since the cosmic rays see these fluctuations as static, you don't really care if they're strongly turbulent or monochromatic waves. The cosmic ray zips through them before they can evolve, and so you recover the same kind of gyroresonance condition as you do for monochromatic waves.
Don't you need a sequence of resonance conditions to actually get a resonance?
It's a subtle thing, I guess, because what you have is not, if you don't have a monochromatic wave, you're right, you don't have a nice sine wave going out to infinity. What you're really doing is say you have some random field structure. The cosmic ray is picking out the periodicity in that field structure and resonating with that periodicity. And that's what gives you scattering.
Infinite decimal amount of power at that
period. Yeah, because it's... But somehow
it's an integral over frequency that must be important.
Well, actually, there's an integral over k that's very important. The frequency, yeah, k.
I mean the k, the spatial frequency.
Yeah.
There's some sort of resonance when you integrate over omega or k that sort of picks out a particular. If you integrate over k, there's a particular resonance that picks out a particular omega or something like that.
Yes, that's the general statement. In this case, we are focusing on a regime where you can basically take omega to be zero, and that gives you this relation for the k that's important.
You can't see
it because
you're standing there. Thanks. These are drifting in the water wave.
Yes. Yes.
So they drift. So after it's gone one wavelength in k parallel, it drifts along that distance. And if that distance is comparable to the k curve inverse wave, you think the scattering would be
weakened. That is one effect that you would get. And I don't get that since I throw away the very largest scale fluctuations. You would get something even from the fluctuations that I include. Like I throw away the very largest ones and keep these. And below some cutoff. And the effect you mentioned could be important. There's another effect which is also important related to the perpendicular wavelength of these particles, which is probably more important, which makes the scattering extremely weak. If you think of this resonance condition again, k parallel is n omega over v parallel. If V parallel is comparable to V perp, so a typical cosmic ray propagation angle relative to the magnetic field, the resonance condition is, again, saying K parallel is like the inverse gyro radius. But for this turbulence model, the Goldreich-Streeter turbulence model, the regions that of the turbulence spectrum that are excited with K parallel equal to the inverse gyro radius of a cosmic ray are along this dashed line to the right of this intersection point. So you get resonance scattering from anything that's excited along that dashed line, but the only place that you get any turbulence is at way out here, where K perp is very large. K perp is actually much larger than the inverse gyro radius. Now, what does that mean? If K perp is much bigger than the inverse gyro radius, that means that the perpendicular wavelength of the mode, lambda perp, is much smaller than the gyro radius. So in a single gyro orbit, the cosmic ray is moving through many uncorrelated fluctuations, each of which gives you a different type of kick to the cosmic ray's momentum, and you're averaging them out. And so the result, after you do that averaging, is very weak scattering. There's an exception to this, namely that if you make theta go to zero, if you make this angle here approach zero, that also makes the gyro radius approach zero. So for very small pitch angles, very small angles of theta, you can make rho as small as you like, and eventually a cosmic ray wouldn't average over many different fluctuations, but would be confined to within a single turbulent fluctuation. That is already taken into account in the quasi-linear calculation, the longitudinal averaging. So if you were to plot a pitch angle scattering rate, nu is the sort of the frequency associated with the random walk in angle. If you were to plot that as a function of pitch angle theta, the plot you'd expect from this gyroresonant scattering would be something like at the bottom of that page, where there would be peaks near parallel and anti-parallel propagation, where the gyro radius is very tiny, and everywhere else where the cosmic ray is averaging in a single gyro orbit over many uncorrelated fluctuations, you get very weak scattering.
Could you maybe explain why scattering is weak in some intuitive terms without having to put some examples?
Yes, I think I could. Let's look at a cosmic ray's orbit, gyro orbit. So the magnetic field, say, is into the blackboard, and a cosmic ray is moving in a big circle. If you have this resonance condition, which is that the parallel wavelength of, and let's take, let me draw a picture of the mode with some parallel wavelength here, lambda parallel, of order the cosmic ray's gyro radius, rho. The perpendicular wavelength of that mode would be much less than rho in the Goldreich-Schrödinger theory. So if you were to look at this gyro orbit here, you'd have a bunch of uncorrelated fluctuations, each represented by different circles here. The cosmic ray sees many different ones. Some of them give it a momentum kick in one direction, others in another, and you have to somehow average out their contribution. That is, I guess, the subject of probably a whole other discussion. There are some specialists here, Jason Marone Sridhar, one of the authors of this theory, probably better to respond to that point maybe at another time or now. And there's another way of
at large scale, quite tangled, but when you look on a small scale, you can't transform it away. So when you look on small scale, it looks like just a straight field.
What scale are we? I mean, we're talking about a range of fields for the gyro radius of what?
This calculation would apply anywhere up to, say, from 10 to the 12 centimeters for one GeV cosmic ray. Then up to say to one parsec, something that's still significantly smaller than the stirring scale. So this would really apply for say a 1 to a 10 to the 6 GeV cosmic ray.
It's not a way, some 8 arcs of magnitude.
The gyro radius compared to the outer scale of the turbulence?
Yeah.
That's true for a 1 GeV cosmic ray, but the gyro radius is proportional to the energy.
You get to about 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19, then EV, then your...
It's actually... So let's see, that would be 10 to the 9, 10 to the 21 centimeters. Yeah, maybe a little higher. Okay, one second kind of scattering that you can get is not the gyroresonance scattering, but something that is probably better referred to as surfing. This is a more intuitive way of thinking of it. This is when there's a parallel force from a wave that, and the wave is moving along with the cosmic ray, pushing the cosmic ray along the magnetic field. If you think of a monochromatic wave, again, you have the same resonance condition where the Doppler shifted frequency seen by the cosmic ray in the frame of reference moving with the cosmic ray along the field it's a multiple of the cosmic ray's gyro frequency. But here we're talking about the n equals zero resonance, which corresponds to this relation that the parallel phase velocity of the mode is equal to the parallel speed of the cosmic ray. So if the cosmic ray is getting a force, well, if the mode exerts a force along the magnetic field on the cosmic ray, then this gives you a resonant pumping of the particle's speed. This doesn't work for Chiral-Fain modes, since they actually don't exert any force on a particle along the magnetic field. The force that works for the pseudo-Alphane modes is the mu grad b force. When if you have a mode that changes the field strength, the mode exerts a force on a cosmic ray given by the cosmic ray's magnetic moment as a gradient of the field strength. And that pushes along the direction of the magnetic field. So the pseudo-Alphane waves can give you this kind of parallel resonance, and the particle can surf along that mode, so to speak. That works for monochromatic waves, as I was just describing. How does it work for strongly turbulent waves, or strong turbulence, where you don't really have waves anymore? Well, you don't get any real resonance now. The modes don't live long enough to push the cosmic ray for very long times. But while they live, they can push particles, and so you get some effect from these waves. There's a condition, however, for either a monochromatic wave or a strongly turbulent mode to push a cosmic ray effectively. You need to have the phase velocity of the mode equal to the parallel velocity of the particle, or in the case of strong turbulence, some analogous quantity. If the mode, again, is moving at the Alphane speed along the magnetic field, the Alphane speed would have to be comparable to the parallel. That only occurs when this value of theta is close to 90 degrees, when the particle is moving nearly perpendicular to the magnetic field. So if you were to ask what you would expect for the scattering rates corresponding to n equals zero modes and plot a scattering rate, nu, versus theta, the angle between the velocity and the magnetic field, this would peak near values of theta equal to pi over 2. And that's what you see when you do the calculation. Strong turbulence would be where the decorrelation time, the correlation time of a mode is comparable to the linear wave frequency that you'd expect for a very small amplitude fluctuation. This is actually related to your earlier question as to what is behind this anisotropy. This region in the K-perp, K-parallel plane is essentially the region where the nonlinear time, K-perp, V-perp, nonlinear rate, K-perp, V-perp, is comparable to or greater than the linear rate, K-parallel, V-alphane. So within this region of K-space, you expect that the modes really are not like Alphane waves, but decorrelating in a random fashion, more like hydrodynamic turbulence.
Ben?
Yes.
Do you get at all into regimes where the wave particle correlation time in the spectrum ends up being comparable to the fluctuation self-correlation time?
What
I'm really driving at is traffic. I mean, if you get into a strongly nonlinear regime, you run into the problem of trapping, and particularly this thing you just mentioned with
surfing.
The moment is a kind of turbulent mirroring effect.
Sure.
And you start to form parallel vortices and all that. And,
right.
How you handle all that?
What I've done here is strictly quasi-linear theory. So you get this turbulent effect of the mirror force. I'm not sure I understand your question about the wave particle correlation time.
For the validity of quasi-linear theory, in other words, using the bare resonance, shall we say, and the diffusion coefficient is in fact that the wave particle or the correlation time, in other words, the spread in K parallel, V parallel, basically exceed the self-correlation rate of the fluctuations.
Right. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yes. In that case, I guess The rates, that's a good question. Could you ever get to the point where that approximation would break down? I think the answer is no, basically. But I'd have to check, because the rates are pretty slow. There might be problems. There might be some problems very near perpendicular propagation.
No, it begs the question of a kind of a turbulent Leonard Mileski equation with the drag due to phase-based granulation as well as quasi-linear diffusion is kind of where that line of reasoning.
Yes, there may well be a place for a more sophisticated analysis of those effects. Let me just flash up here briefly the math. What you get from the quasi-linear theory is you're trying to calculate diffusion coefficients for the particles in momentum space. And let me turn off this light. F in the top equation is the cosmic ray distribution function. And these different D quantities correspond to diffusion coefficients. This C is the pitch angle cosine. It's basically V parallel over V. It's the angle, essentially. P is the magnitude of the cosmic ray's momentum. And what the turbulence does is it scatters you an angle that's given by this angular diffusion coefficient. There also is diffusion in magnitude of momentum, diffusion in energy, and these cross terms here. You can calculate each of those different diffusion coefficients for the Goldreich-Schwedhar power spectrum, and you get these two results. One of these for the shear alphane wave, this is for the pseudo alphane wave, and what these are integrals over k of the different spectra of the turbulence, the magnetic power spectrum, the kinetic power spectrum, the cross helicity spectrum. I haven't taken into account magnetic helicity. And there are extra factors here related to the correlation, time correlation of the fluctuations, and also this k-perp averaging in a single gyro orbit of a cosmic ray. These are general formulas for any spectra of shear alphane and pseudo-alphane turbulence, but for the Goldreich-Schwedhar form, you can actually reduce these general formulas to these formulas here, at least asymptotically. There are two small parameters in the problem, delta, the ratio of the alphane speed to the particle speed, which is 10 to the minus 4 in the interstellar medium. In epsilon, this is basically the ratio of the V over omega is like the gyro radius of the cosmic ray, divided by L, the outer scale of the turbulence. This is another small quantity for the cosmic rays below the knee of the energy spectrum. To lowest order in these two quantities, you can do some asymptotics on these general formulas and get formulas that are much easier to plot. And if you plot the pitch angle scattering rate, it looks like this. Having those general features I mentioned earlier, you have peaks in the scattering rate, this is the angular scattering rate, near parallel and anti-parallel propagation, and also near perpendicular propagation. When the particle is moving slowly along the field, it can somehow not really resonate with, but interact strongly with the mirror force of the pseudo-alphane modes. It can see them more coherently over longer periods of time. And there are two things plotted here. The solid line is the asymptotic formula. The x's are numerical evaluations of the general formula for the quasilinear scattering. For
this is scattering now by scales of RHS. Yeah.
No, this is there are actually two different things that you see here. I've excluded the scales of order L a priori to use the quasilinear thing. L, because L sort of controls the shape of this spectrum, if you pick out some K here that you're resonating with, actually you can't see it, say you pick out some K that you're resonating with, and you want to know, you're picking out some K parallel that you're resonating with, and you want to know how far out you have to go to find fluctuations that give you any scattering, L appears there. There is some resonance here with large-scale modes, not of order L. This mirror force scattering is, you get a contributions effectively from throughout your spectrum, equal contributions from each logarithmic interval to this mirror force scattering. Up here, this is gyro-resonance scattering dominating the contribution. near theta equals zero. That's from very small scale fluctuations. What do I assume? I assume that it's exactly the same as a Schier-Alphane spectrum, same power is a Schier-Alphane spectrum, that the dissipation scale is somewhat larger. Amplitude is the same. The dissipation scale of the pseudo-Alphane spectrum also doesn't play a role, but the amplitude is the same. Okay, so this is the basic calculation of the scattering rates. What can you learn about it related to, say, cosmic ray propagation or shock acceleration? One of the key things that you want to do is get from this a scattering mean-free path, a distance that a cosmic ray must travel. Actually, I'll leave these off. Before it changes direction. That's something I'll call lambda. And it turns out to be just an integral over that over angle, or pitch angle cosine c, involving that scattering rate nu. This is the integral that you obtain for that scattering mean-free path lambda. You can evaluate this analytically, at least to lowest order in those two small parameters. What you find is an enormous scattering mean-free path. It's the outer scale of the turbulence times a very large quantity, v over v alphane. What we needed was a 1 parsec scattering mean-free path to explain cosmic ray confinement. But here, what this is saying is it's something like a megaparsec from this turbulence alone. The scattering is extremely weak if you assume the just Goldreich-Schrödinger turbulence. And this clearly would not be a mechanism for confining cosmic rays if this was the only thing that was happening.
You're saying that the cosmic rays just stream out a lot of field lines, which go like that. Unless the field lines turn over on themselves by some magical mechanism on a very small length scale,
right, and in fact, even if you take into account the fact that the field lines are primarily in the plane of the galaxy and rarely leave the plane to go up into the halo, you would still need some value of lambda that's far smaller than this to explain confinement. There's a lot of work done on the three-dimensional diffusion of cosmic rays for different models of the interstellar magnetic field. And generally, you need lambda to be of order a parsec or a few parsecs to give.
If this is all assuming you have this n-hypothesis, so
right.
There must be some classical result when it's not.
Yes.
The result?
Then you get a very nice answer. You get that if the classic result is if you take all of the wave vectors of the fluctuations to be along the magnetic field, so this is the opposite sense of anisotropy from Goldreich and Sridhar. If you have B0 up like this and K is parallel, then you get strong scattering that also scales with energy in the way you want it to. You want the scattering to get essentially weaker as you go to higher energies.
This is with a Kolmogorov spectrum.
Or Kolmogorov, it doesn't matter. If you take some power law, but you put all of the power into modes like this, you get good scattering.
But what if K is isotropic?
You get similar results. If it's isotropic, you again get nice scattering of cosmic rays that would explain, at least would be consistent with confinement times. There is an important question which, to my knowledge, hasn't been satisfactorily answered. Namely, if you go back, I'll come back to this view graph in a minute. But if you go back to the power spectrum, this is where most of the power is seen in the simulations. It's not yet clear, could there be some fraction of the power leaking out into this other region? And if so, how much would it be? If there was even a few percent or 10% getting out into the rest of the K-perp, K-parallel plane, that small fraction of the energy would dominate the scattering. So that could also be important. Okay.
But that's what
V
means by its
comparability. I mean, that is, in delta V is comparable to V8 or something.
Right, that's true.
That
scale, you really don't get much in any theory. Those other theories give you strong scattering from the small scale fluctuations. like to get strong scattering, you need to assume either isotropy or K parallel to B. But the region of the K perp K parallel plane that will give you strong scattering isn't the low K part. It's with larger values of K parallel actually.
But, I mean, how large are you really sure that it's in the part of K space? I mean, this basically depends on K parallel. So
right.
How strong
the scattering is. So, what length is K parallel? Does it have to be? It has to be of order the inverse of the gyro radius of the cosmic ray.
Less, approximately or less.
Or less, but actually generally less. It's this the wavelength lambda parallel would have to be equal to the gyro radius essentially, which is 10 to the 12 centimeters times the energy in GeV. So for a 10 to the 6 GeV particle, yes, one parsec for a little bit less, but for most of them, significantly less.
If the field is tangled, could spatial scattering help you with confinement?
Spatial scattering, I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, in other words, if you're running along the field and the field line is stochastic, so
yes.
It starts to wander, so the
right.
Particle is...
Yes, that certainly plays. Yes, the cross-field diffusion certainly plays a big role in this. And in fact, it can help you get your particles out of the galaxy.
In this case, though, if the particles want to go out along the field, cross-field diffusion might help keep them in a sense.
Yes, it turns out, however, that for most models of the cross-field diffusion, based on the Rochester-Rosenbluth phenomenology, you still get a constraint for what you need for lambda. And it needs to be vastly smaller than what you get from this model, orders and orders of magnitude smaller.
The confinement time is between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 4 light travel time. So that you can take that scale up to the actual model.
Just going to ask the scattering. This is based on resonant scattering, but couldn't you, if you had non-resonant scattering, it wouldn't. So in other words, the parsec condition just based on the fact that you want us to be resonant scattering, or is there a region that you want us to be trapped within a...
Actually, no, the one parsec condition doesn't really care if you have resonant or non-resonant scattering. Any kind of scattering that would give you...
But supposing that on larger scale, things trapped in 10 or 15 parsec regions that they were trapped, that would violate the observation constraint.
So you'd be saying, like, if you had isolated magnetic blobs that weren't connected to other regions, could you get trapped inside?
Trapped in there on the scale of the largest, where the turbulent, where the quasi-linear approximation breaks down, you would have isotropic stuff, but they would be trapped now on the characteristic scales of L.
Yeah.
I'd
like to move on.
Yes.
Talk about
the classical theory you're talking about. I'm familiar with the work. Early 1970s by Lurch and Goldsmith.
That's the part of the problem that I'm not talking about. That's the self-excited waves, which can be important to confine cosmic rays at energies below 100 to 1,000 GeV, but not at higher energies.
Okay,
Eric, yes, you've asked a terrific question that will help me move right to the next topic here. What else? Suppose you want to get some other mechanism that could confine cosmic rays in the absence of strong scattering. What could it be? Well, it could be self-confinement. Maybe we don't understand self-confinement. It could be extra power outside of the Goldreich-Schriedhar cone in other regions of K-perp, K-parallel space that give us more scattering than you get from this estimate. Another thing it could be is molecular clouds. Molecular clouds can be effective magnetic mirrors. If you take a field line in the ISM, as it travels through the galactic disk, it will tend to be focused into a molecular cloud complex every 300 parsecs or so. Once it enters a complex, it tends to be focused into the densest clumps in the complex. So the complex has nested structures of different densities and field strengths, and it turns out from simple scaling estimates, and there's some evidence from Ake's simulations that this may be true in his turbulent simulations, that field lines tend to be focused very effectively into strong field regions. That is sensitive to how you model the cloud. Let me tell you how I model the cloud and how I arrived at this conclusion. basically taking this scaling law that Aki was talking about yesterday, the field strength in a clump is proportional to the density of the half power, you can get scalings from observations of the density of a clump of size R as a function of R, and also the number of such clumps is a function of R. And these are two laws, scaling laws I've taken from a couple recent papers. Then you can ask the question, what is the total flux going through clumps of size between R and 2R? Well, it's the number of such clumps, which is just R times dNdR, times the flux through each clump, BR squared. And that scales like R to the minus 0.35 power, which says that there's more flux going through the smallest clumps with the highest field than there is through the largest clumps. The only way you get that is if a single field line entering the complex goes through several of these smallest clumps, which would suggest that cosmic rays would see these very strong field regions, which are magnetic mirrors. They can reflect cosmic rays effectively. What time is it now? It's That's another thing that plays an important role. And in fact, what you get in the end, let me just give you sort of what the punchline of this, which is, now think about what a cosmic ray's motion through the galaxy will look like. It can be trapped between neighboring cloud complexes for very long times. As you say, there can be jumping across field lines as a cosmic ray drifts in the large-scale field. If a cosmic ray is initially trapped between A and B, complexes A and B, it might drift across field lines, become trapped between A and D. That's a different picture of cosmic ray diffusion than we're typically used to. How quickly that happens depends a lot upon the topology of the galactic field and how field line wandering behaves in the galaxy. If you need basically to take into account this exponential divergence of neighboring field lines that was earlier mentioned to get that perpendicular diffusion to be important. You also can have cosmic rays diffusing along the field and eventually getting out of the galaxy. That is slowed by these magnetic mirrors. I could say more in detail about this, but let me just make the point that even for very weak scattering, if you take into account magnetic mirrors in clouds, you can recover the confinement times that you need. You can also explain cosmic ray isotropy. The cosmic rays are observed to be nearly isotropic in their distribution as a function of angle of arrival to within a factor of about 10 to the minus 3. Since it's the flow of cosmic rays that drives anisotropy, these magnetic mirrors can reduce that flow and allow you to recover isotropy even if you have weaker scattering.
Is the transport in that system even diffusive?
I'm not convinced. Yeah, well, here it could be diffusive depending, again, on what you assume.
Cloud density. In other words, the packing fraction of the space with clouds, right?
That's important. I think you even, for what you would expect for galactic parameters, you expect something like diffusion if you make certain assumptions.
We actually looked at whether Brian's contribution, whether it became better.
Oh, yes, that was for the parallel transport, not for the perpendicular transport. Oh, okay, yeah, the parallel transport, yes, it can become Levy flights.
So how large do you require the clumps to be in clouds in order to provide the time scale?
That you need. It depends, like for the numbers that I gave there, what you need pretty large field strengths in clouds. The only way I've modeled this so far is with isotropic scattering as a function, with pitch angle scattering is constant as a function of theta. I haven't revisited the calculation with this revised picture for the dependence on angle, so I can't give you an exact answer for what you would need to explain the confinement time. Actually, I'm not being clear enough. What I mean by isotropic scattering is that the scattering rate nu would not depend upon the angle at which the cosmic ray is propagating. In fact, it does. And this is something I've done since the earlier works taking into account molecular clouds. If you take alpha to be of order, basically, there's several different regimes. It's unfortunately nastily complex. In one of them, the diffusion coefficient goes like 1 over alpha squared. So if you if you needed to reduce the diffusion coefficient by a factor of, say, 10 to the 6, you need alpha to be 10 to the 3, which is unlikely. That's very optimistic.
Is that an alpha field strength?
It's proportional to the field strength, sorry.
Yeah,
it is the ratio of the cloud, the maximum field strength, to the intercloud field strength.
So you need a factor?
Yeah, you need milligauss fields in the clumps. You might have those. But the thing that I haven't taken, the thing I haven't also taken into account is the fact that this peaking of the scattering rate in the passing region. I haven't explained this, but perhaps some people here are familiar with the fact that the cosmic rays that are nearly parallel propagating go through the molecular clouds. Those are the ones that you want to scatter the most because they're the ones that can go farthest. The scattering is stronger for them because of the effects I was mentioning earlier. So you may not need the full factor of 1,000 to get the...
It's almost perfect, actually. You've got no scattering on the passing particles and almost no scattering on the trapped particles. It's just perfect.
Yeah, it's unfortunately...
Once you stay trapped in the passing world.
Yeah, unfortunately, this depends a whole lot on what alpha is, because if alpha is only, say, alpha, I guess I haven't even explained what that is yet. If you take alpha to be the maximum field strength encountered over the inner cloud field strength, so if you take that to be 20, then this region here is like 1 over alpha in angle, and it extends for a lot of cosmic rays way beyond the strong scattering region. So that becomes very, like the value of alpha becomes very critical in determining how much you gain from this peaking of the scattering rate. There's a whole lot of...
Peaking of the scattering rate associated with passing particles?
Yeah.
What do you mean by passing particles?
I'm trying to wrap this up quickly without explaining the rest of everything that's on the view graphs. Maybe...
We can give it a...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, basically the idea behind these passing particles is that a magnetic mirror is good at trapping particles that are not moving exactly along the magnetic field. So if this angle here, theta, is very small, the particle can go through the molecular cloud. That's what I mean by the passing particles.
But there's a strong scattering, you say?
Yes, in this plot here...
It gets scattered into the trapped ones, which can't move along with you.
Yes, you see that...
The passing ones can get scattered into being trapped particles.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, the thing is, that factor of 1,000 I quoted to you is actually more than you need, because really what happens here is that the particles you're really worried about are the ones that are going to go through the mirrors, these passing particles. If they go through very quickly, they can leak out fast. How do you keep them in? Well, you only need to change them from being a passing particle into a trapped particle. You need to scatter them by a very small angle, from say theta equals 0 to theta of order 1 over alpha, where alpha is this field strength ratio. That doesn't take too much time, especially if you have a larger scattering rate in that region. There are several different cases that one needs to consider for finding the overall diffusion coefficient in terms of the relation of the different parameters.
You may have, I mean, the turbulence will be much more isotropic in the cloud.
Yes, most of this scattering is actually going to occur in the region between the clouds, since the cosmic ray spends most of its time between the clouds. What actually happens right near the clouds could also be important, and also there's this other study that Steve, Brian Albright, and I have been working on about what could happen right near a molecular cloud magnetic mirror. You could excite other types of turbulence potentially that could further complicate this picture.
What's the typical separation between clouds?
About 300 parsecs in the model I'm using. I don't know how robust that is. It depends in part upon the average field strength in a cloud, because that tends to focus the field lines into the cloud and reduce the separation along field lines.
Back close to the clouds, you'd expect an anisotropic distribution, because only the passing ones are getting through the cloud. So one of the issues is whether that's anisotropic enough to excite other patterns.
The mirror
in
the
cloud is also exciting. So what you said about the lifetime being 10 million years,
There are actually two independent configurations where it's from. It's the amount of material the cosmic rays pass through.
Right.
And there's the actual time measured from decay of radioactive species.
Right.
10. And you can put those two things together to come up with an average density of the cosmic ray centers over time. And it's about 0.2. It's quite a low number.
Yeah.
So I think what that says that your model is that the field lines between the molecular clouds must go some distance into the halo. That's substantially lower than the average.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. I'm seeing, you have a problem in explaining this because you were talking about the divergence of field lines.
Right.
There are going to be regions where that divergence could be actually very large. There's some reconnection going on somewhere. And here's an idea. It can go anywhere, but if you believe in a galactic dynamo, you can't get a galactic dynamo to work unless there's a certain amount of reconnection going on.
Mm-hmm.
Given that there's an average galactic field, I don't know if there's a way of estimating how big the regions and how strong the spread is in various regions of reconnection. Maybe there's a way of doing that. I don't know.
There's been a lot of work on this question, and there's hugely differing answers as to how quickly the field lines diverge, and it's critical for how this works, because if the field lines diverge a lot, you're never really trapped between two field lines, because you could leave between two cloud complexes, because you start leaving cloud A, you think you're going towards cloud B, but there's enough field line divergence that you end up going off to cloud D,
and then it's just jumping back and forth
between different clouds.
And therefore, never be on a field line that takes you all the way up.
Or only some fraction of the time.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think that kind of effect is very important, trying to distinguish.
There isn't a good way of making the estimate. I just suggested, so that's where it goes.
I think, let me give a comment on what I think are some of the important things that one needs to sort of keep in mind from this work. I don't think this work is, by any means, giving a final answer on propagation or even shock acceleration. I think the main thing that comes out of the main thing that we're trying to do is explain this uniformity in the power spectrum over so many decades in energy. And that really suggests that there's sort of a uniform mechanism affecting uniform acceleration mechanism over many decades of energy and a sort of uniform propagation mechanism over many decades in energy. There's a real problem that this study seems to point out, namely that if you go above energies of 100 GeV or 1,000 GeV, where self-excited waves are believed to be unimportant, where the cosmic rays can no longer generate resonant waves that can scatter them at those high energies, then the nature of the scattering changes, which implies that the nature of the propagation and acceleration change, and yet you don't see any feature at around 100 to 1,000 GeV. Now, I think there are a couple probable resolutions to this. In terms of the acceleration of cosmic rays, why don't we see any break at that critical energy? Well, the work that I was discussing on shock acceleration was mostly for parallel shock acceleration. This critical energy, 100 to 1,000 GeV, that's the maximum energy you can generate accelerate to in a shock where the magnetic field is parallel to the shock normal. So here's B. And here's your shock front propagating away from a supernova. When those two things are parallel, this problem arises. When B is almost perpendicular to the shock, which is what one would expect for a supernova shock going off into a stellar wind cavity where the field lines have been wrapped up and are primarily toroidal, this problem of the scattering isn't so important. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done on perpendicular shock acceleration to understand these issues of cross-field diffusion, which become important there. That sort of may take care of this sort of uniformity problem, at least up to the knee, from the point of view of acceleration. But from the point of view of propagation, it seems to me that there is a still outstanding problem. Why don't you see any kind of feature in the spectrum associated to this change in the nature of the scattering? And maybe there's something wrong in in our models. Maybe there is more energy outside of the Goldreich Schreder cone, some residual energy, even 10%, that could dominate the scattering and explain this. Maybe there's some other paradigms that one has to consider about, say, the topology of the magnetic field, and thinking instead of a diffusion coefficient characterizing the loss, thinking in terms of perhaps how often do you hit a field line that leaves the galactic plane. There's sort of a rate for encountering those and staying on those, which is a separate issue from a diffusion coefficient.
But if they're so isotropic, I mean, the sources of cosmic rays, presumably they're discrete, so something must be identified with them,
yeah.
You know, pretty much everywhere within the galaxy.
Yeah. Now, so yes, I'm not trying to suggest that you can do away with scattering. I think you absolutely need it. But you actually don't need nearly as much as in the classic models. The classic models have a scattering rate, which is of order, like a scattering time of order a year. Now, what you really need to, say, generate anisotropy levels of order 10 to the minus 3 is that anisotropy, 10 to the minus 3, is something like Well, it's actually, I think it might be more complicated than that. If you think of cosmic rays leaving the galaxy on a time scale, on some time scale, tau loss, and you have some tau scatter, you basically, this loss could be diffusive, taking into account not just distance to that source, but the fact that the cosmic ray may have gone around the galaxy a fair bit before you encounter it. And so what you need from this kind of estimate is scattering rates that are scattering times that are of order, say, 10 to the 4 years, which would be scattering mean free paths of, you know, over a kiloparsec, a few kiloparsecs. That's all you really need to explain isotropy. The molecular cloud magnetic mirrors can help you explain the confinement times from there.
So you talked about pitch angle scattering, but
yeah.
How does the anisotropic turbulence affect the diffusion across field lines?
Oh, the cross field lines.
What dominates the loss rate. So you must relate it in some indirect way.
Yes. It turns out that there are two things. Like, it turns out that what one normally says is that every time you scatter in direction, let's say you're moving along the magnetic field, a distance lambda, to isotropize your direction. So you undergo one collision in that length. The normal presumption is that you move a distance of order your gyro radius perpendicular to the field during that time. That's from the scattering. It's a typical result from quasi-linear theory. If you take into account anisotropy, this lambda is so large that this mechanism for cross-field diffusion becomes basically unimportant. A more important mechanism is the drifts in the presence of the large-scale magnetic field, which dominate cross-field diffusion. And then they say that estimate says that every time you move a distance of the outer scale of your turbulence, L, along the magnetic field, you move perpendicular to the magnetic field, distance of order rho.
But isn't your estimate for how long it takes them to escape, doesn't that basically, doesn't that depend on cross field, not on pitch angle?
It depends.
The field line might leave.
That's not affected by the pitch angle
scattering. Right. The interesting thing about the cross field.
Question of whether you diffuse across the field line faster,
yes, yes.
Than by diffusion on the field line, just the field line itself.
Right.
But it seems like this limits diffusion across the field line a great deal.
Not so much, actually, because the drifting alone is enough to give you small perpendicular drifts. And then what happens is that neighboring field lines, which are diverging from one another, similar to the type of phenomenology that we were discussing in the Lazarian-Vishniak paper, this divergence of neighboring field lines, it amplifies the effects of the locally weak motions across the magnetic field, so that if you look over larger scales of order the size of the galactic, say the scale height, the particle does in fact get off of its initial field line onto uncorrelated lines in a way that we don't yet fully understand.
Isn't the relevant question here basically the amount of the drift excursion versus the perpendicular correlation length of the turbulence. That's the critical thing of why the drift makes for better runaway confinement in tokamaks, right? The drift shifts the resonance through the spectrum, in a sense.
Okay, let's see if I understand correctly.
I think here it's the fact that, you know, if you're trapped in a mirror or something, you get a secular drift. It's not diffusive at all. It just drifts out.
There is diffusion.
You're talking about radial diffusion.
There's both.
The question about it's the faster you move across the field line, the drift out of the mirror will be effective radial diffusion. And the diffusion length will be something like L. The velocity will be Vd. So the typical diffusion rate from it will be V drift times L, which is basically V thermal times rho.
Yes.
Much faster than mu rho squared, which is the diffusion rate from collisions.
Well, yeah, that's very important, but you still have to, basically these secular drifts from the larger scale fluctuations, which do not satisfy the diffusive sort of constraint, give you enough. But you still have to take into account, if you didn't take into account divergence, you'd get nowhere with cross-field diffusion. You have to take this into account. And this is a big unsolved question, how quickly they diverge from one another. So you're saying if you basically have the field lines all coming back, going up into the halo, coming back down, say, then parallel, if you have no perpendicular or very limited perpendicular diffusion, that would say that, yeah, they could go round and round many times before coming back. That type of argument is, I think, very important, and it's not typically captured in the standard treatments where you just try to get a diffusion coefficient because it doesn't respect topology. But that may be very important.
But since the drift center of the resonance coefficient, the resonance function, they must then affect the diffusion and thus the divergence length.
I think that the divergence length, it may be independent. Like if you think of the field lines, is a static system of field lines and don't take into account the particle yet, and you just ask about the topology. Yeah, okay. Okay, okay. But then the drift, I'm not sure how the drift comes into that.
Well, because you have the resonance, is, instead of being 1 over k parallel v, is now 1 over k parallel v minus omega drift. So there's a shift in the resonance function.
I see, for the scattering. I guess you'd still get magnetostatic scattering. The fluctuations would still look static.
But it'll change.
The observational evidence magnetic fluctuations.
There is some from the solar wind, and there's conflicting or ambiguous, I should say, evidence from the solar wind. There's a paper that Mel Goldstein talked about, one paper on this topic, and this is the paper with the so-called Maltese cross, which finds evidence for. Doesn't find evidence for the Goldreich-Sridhar theory. It finds short parallel wavelengths as well as short perpendicular wavelengths. There's another study which gets more support for the Goldreich-Sridhar theory. This is I can't remember all the authors. It's Bieber et al. And they basically do something like this. They take a satellite in the solar wind, propagating outward, and they look at the correlation length. The frequency at different times when the magnetic field orientation, the mean sort of Parker spiral field, is at different angles to the flow direction. And this, if you were to postulate a k-parallel and k-perp, if k-parallel were much, if say k-perp were much bigger than k-parallel, then in this case, where the field is perpendicular to the flow, you'd have faster fluctuations. And they do a test based on, I think, it's a limited amount of data, and find that they say 80% to 85% are in these high k-perp modes at some point in the inertial range. It's not very specific information as to which theory is correct.
Is that experiment also sensitive to alternating turbulence? That is k-parallel?
It is, because the magnetic field fluctuation sorry, the mean field is sometimes, is actually not in general exactly perpendicular to the flow, so they can't see K parallel.
In that. All these experiments you set up from the classic satellite problem, which is this one point in space, so you don't separate omega and K.
The other evidence is from radio scintillation, right?
And that's very weak evidence. Yeah, you get anisotropy. Like, from radio scintillation, you can look at the scattering disks at the diffractive scale of about 10 to the 9 centimeters, and you get that the scattering disks are anisotropic, but the aspect ratios are like 1.5. If you were to look at the prediction of the Goldreich-Sridhar theory for what the fluctuations would look like at 10 to the 9 centimeters, the anisotropy ratio would be about 1,000. Now, what they see in scintillation is a line integral through a whole turbulent region where the magnetic field may be changing directions. And how that averaging affects this result hasn't been calculated, but one expects that even these only marginally anisotropic results could be consistent with much higher local. Well, it depends on the source. How does this number here scale with the number of, say, large scales in the field?
It says that number is 1/√n × 1,000.
What's huge, and it wouldn't work because then you need like a million. But I don't think one of
calculation was radio scintillation. Well, it had two regions, one like this and another perpendicular. I think you're almost completely as
close. Yeah.
There are evidence for this. There is a correlation between the elongation of these images and the direction of the mean magnetic field in a galaxy. Mean magnetic field in a galaxy, let's say, is roughly parallel to the plane. If you look at many of these scattering disks, they're elongated, they're perpendicular to, nearly perpendicular to within 5 degrees or something. Some observations, I think, Gwynn, Desai, and Spandler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Aren't there regions in the interstellar medium where you know that the line of sight has only one field direction because you see synchrotron radiation which is optimally polarized?
I am not aware of that.
Does anybody know the answer to that? I think in the early synchrotron maps, it were spots where the field apparently was parallel all the way along the line of sight, very close to parallel. Because the polarization is so high.
Well, on the average, the polarization is about half.
Yeah, sure. So in the polarization maps, you look for a place where it's, you know, near the maximum, which is about 0.7, something like that. And if you find a quasar behind that, then
you know all the
way.
What? You know all the way.
In interplanetary scintillation, you find much larger ratios. I've seen numbers like 1:6.
Uh-huh.
There we know the magnetic field is sort of stretched and it's overall the line, if you look in a given direction.
Sure.
Now, in stress after stuff. Yeah. In terms of the number of, I guess it depends on which angle you look, perhaps, but in terms of the number of outer scales you expect along the line of sight through the interplanetary medium, do you know roughly how many that would be?
Well, it's not just outer scales, but their relative orientation.
Yeah.
Magnetic field could be sort of stretched along the solar band near the, close to the sun.
Yeah.
So if the spread and angles are small, then all the areas are sort of nearly lined up.
Yeah. I guess
I don't know what the statistics are.
Okay.
Function elongation.
My understanding was that delta B in the solar wind is comparable to B. Is that
on the other
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then I guess that you could have locally, wouldn't you expect locally then like 45 degree changes in angle in the field or maybe
question. Another question that supernova phase. if you ask what time does it take for the entire galactic volume to be reinfluenced by this?